WTUL New Orleans News and Views, and I'm Maggie Herman. There is a new cycle of social movement in Nicaragua called the April Insurrection, or La Insurrección de Abril. It is the biggest uprising since the Civil War ended in 1990. The movement ignited on April 18th, when Nicaraguans took to the street to protest a more narrow issue. President Ortega had proposed Social Security reforms that would raise income and payroll taxes while reducing pension benefits. Demonstrators opposing this change were met with intense violence from authorities, followed by the deployment of the Nicaraguan army ordered by President Ortega. The violent response set off a ripple effect, as students and other groups across the country raised voices against governmental repression and censorship of dissent, as well as violations of human rights. I was joined in conversation shortly after the April insurrection began by WTUL affiliate Alexandra, who has family on the ground in Nicaragua, as well as Dr. Pamela Newman, a postdoctoral fellow at Tulane University in the Stone Center of Latin American Studies. Dr. Newman did her PhD in sociology at the University of Texas in Austin and has a master's in Latin American Studies. She currently does research on gender-based violence and feminist activism in Nicaragua. We talked through the social movement, what led up to it and where it's headed, as well as the role of social media and technology in civil unrest and student movements going on right now in Nicaragua. I started the conversation by asking Dr. Newman where the reactions to the protest came from, and here's where the conversation went from there.
Because the government has used intimidation, it has used harassment, it has used different kinds of tactics to try to shut down protests in the past. But in this instance, like when there was a small group of protesters that came out initially to protest these Social Security reforms, the government immediately reacted in this very violent way. I mean, there was immediately people dying. And I think that was so shocking for many Nicaraguan students, especially in like the universities, that the second day there were more people on the street. And then the repression like accelerated. And then there were kind of like multiple groups. And so it was hard to say like, which people were killed by the police versus like the Juventud Sandinista versus maybe like some gangs, some neighborhood gangs who got involved. You know, it was kind of all getting mixed up together. But seeing so many people die, you know, and bleeding on the streets, like Nicaraguans haven't seen that happen since the revolution.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's why it was so shocking. Like, it wasn't just intimidation, like we're going to block your path or we're going to yell things at you. It was like police using, you know, real bullets.
Yeah.
On students.
And what is that something that was a typical reaction to this protest? You're saying this kind of organizing maybe was something that was seen for the first time in a while. And so
student organizing.
The student organizing.
I did think WhatsApp and like Snap, like all those social media sites played a role, like played this like kind of feedback loop, you know, instead of like everyone like being scared and backing down, like people were sending videos of like, look, the police are stopping, you know, like people sending, like people with food and water who are going to go to the protesters, like, look, we're recording you, you're being watched on camera. Or like if like police officers were like grabbing this protester, they were like, we're recording you, we're going to share this.
Mm-hmm.
And like it became this feedback loop where every day, like when the police became more violent, like more people were like, well, we're going to go protest and we are going to do what we can because, mm-hmm. you know, and then like more people were sending videos and like mm-hmm. I saw like a lot more people actually like standing up to the police even in face of all of this
mm-hmm.
gunfights. Because normally, well, I haven't really like, I've never seen like protests and like in Nicaragua up hand, so I don't really know how people normally react.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I'm not entirely sure why they reacted so strongly immediately with the killings.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's a generation of students who have been excluded for so long from both politics and the economy. And I think, you know, they've grown up knowing nothing but Ortega since he's been back in power. And I think, you know, that group of students are highly networked, as you were saying, using things like WhatsApp. And so they were communicating with each other in a way that maybe wasn't possible at first. So it was easier for people to react faster than they might have been able to if they were relying on phone calls, you know, because many Nicaraguan people that I know often don't have saldo. They don't have minutes to call or to text. But now, like, there's free internet in a lot of public places in Nicaragua. Like, in parks, there's free Wi-Fi. And so a lot of people have taken advantage of that. And so the use of technology, I think, explains in part the rapid response.
Mm-hmm. And what is kind of, you don't have to go so in-depth, but kind of the story of Ortega's
position of power, ascent to power, and his role as kind of, I mean, I was reading a little bit today, one of the last leftist-leaning people of power in Latin America right now.
Yeah, so Ortega is best known as being the leader of Nicaragua during the Sandinista Revolution, and then after the revolution won in 1979, he was Nicaragua's president throughout the 1980s, and then due to pressure from the United States government, eventually Nicaragua was forced to hold another election in which Ortega lost to Violeta Barrios de Chamorro, who was the widow, of a very famous Nicaraguan journalist. And then there were about 15 years in which Ortega was out of power, but continued to really mobilize people from below. So he was very active politically, putting pressure on the opposition government that was in power, and made some agreements, some pactos, as they call them in Spanish, with different political leaders, one of them being a former president of Nicaragua, to kind of divide control of Nicaragua's institutions. And this is something that's been going on basically since the mid-1990s, where basically these two political parties, the Sandinistas and the opposition, divided up the spots in different institutions, like the Supreme Court, like the National Assembly, the municipalities. And there was kind of an agreement, like, we're going to kind of share power between us. And one of the agreements they came to is that they would lower the threshold for the percentage that you would need to win a national presidential election. And so when Ortega was reelected finally again in 2006, it was only with 38% of the vote. Because by that point, you only needed 35% and a 5% margin to win. And he had that. And so, and the opposition was very divided. And so that allowed Ortega to kind of get back in there. And at first, like I did mention earlier, there was some optimism that this could be a lot better than the previous kind of era of neoliberal policies, where the government had really shrunk. There wasn't a lot of healthcare. There was very little investment in education. So people thought, okay, the Sandinistas are back in power. They're going to invest more money in social policy. This is going to be good for the country. And there did, some of that did happen, like more housing, things like that. But at the same time, there was a move on Ortega's part to really consolidate his position by trying to exclude potential challengers within his own party as well as opposition parties. And so that eventually led to a series of elections where little by little the FSLN, his party, won more and more of those elections. And because he had control of the Electoral Council, which kind of oversaw the whole election processes, people started to not even really believe that these elections were fair and transparent anymore. And so that was one of the main mechanisms by which he kind of consolidated power.
Okay. What is the country's relationship to dissent in the past? Like you were saying, maybe there hasn't been a point where there's been like large dissent or opportunity for dissent, and this is the first time in a while that there's been that surge. But what is, I mean, is there room or opportunity for dissent in that relationship to power?
So I would say Nicaragua has a very strong history of dissent because of the revolution, mm-hmm. when the Sandinistas overthrew this 40-some-odd-year dictatorship.
Which was in
the Somoza dictatorship. So that started in the 1930s and went through 1979 when it was finally overthrown.
Okay.
So I would say, like, that history of revolutionary activism is really strong in Nicaragua.
Yeah.
And what has happened over time is that the spaces for dissent have been slowly closed because of the fact that Ortega has been consolidating power and threatening people who express dissenting views. And a really good example of this is the feminist movement in Nicaragua. So the feminist movement actually sprang out of the Sandinista movement. They were affiliated with the Sandinistas back in the 1980s, but then they eventually became autonomous in the 1990s after the Sandinistas were no longer in power. And over time, they've developed this very oppositional relationship. So now Ortega sees the feminists and their movement as a threat and does everything he can to keep them from gaining additional power and leverage in society, and making agreements, for example, with religious organizations instead. So like the religious hierarchy, you know, for example, agreeing to outlaw abortion in Nicaragua in all circumstances, right? Like not even for the life of the mother, things like that. So I would say these movements have always been there. The problem is there's been less space and, you know, there's been more more intimidation, for sure.
And then the more brutal response coming from the police force and the Sandinistas Juventud. Is it Sandinistas Juventudes?
Juventud Sandinistas. Yes, the Sandinista youth is what they're called.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And where was their big, you know, push of violence coming from, do you think?
I mean, the Juventud Sandinista have been part of sort of, they've been a tool that the Ortega government has used to try to intimidate protesters of various different groups in society for a long time. So they've been used to intimidate women's groups who have protested on issues like violence, on femicide. They've been used to intimidate campesinos who have been protesting against this canal that was scheduled to be built all the way across Nicaragua and take land from hundreds of farmers. And so that group of people has been sent out before to do that. And I think, you know, for there to be live bullets involved, that has to involve a higher level of authority. Like, somebody had to give that order that this was going to be acceptable this time, because that wasn't the case before.
Yeah, so then, like, the Sandinistas Juventud, I know them as, I know my family calls them, like, just, like, the gangs that Ortega pays to go cause destruction. I never knew, like, what they were other than that, just colloquial, like, that's what they, people mm-hmm. call them.
Mm-hmm. Turbas, they call them.
Yeah.
In Spanish, yeah.
Yeah, and, like, I know they started, like, causing destruction in, like, just the the general cityscape, you know? Like, they were causing fires, like, they burned, I think on, like, day 3 is when they burned down the church and they burned down this other building.
Mm-hmm. A radio station was burned down.
Yeah.
In another city, not in the capital. So there was several, like, acts of vandalism, and then there was also, like, a spurt of looting in grocery stores in Managua, and that was either on the 3rd or 4th day, and, you know, there was a lot of sort of questioning, like, who's behind this, and some people thought it was an attempt to discredit the student protesters who had initiated everything, and other people were saying, like, no, it's obviously not, like, look at people in these neighborhoods where the supermarkets are actually coming out to defend them, mm-hmm. you know, and prevent looting from happening, so... but then it kind of all came to a head when President Ortega finally, like, came out and made a statement and basically said, like, okay, we're going to not do this Social Security reform that had been proposed by executive decree. And so after that, things seemed to calm down a little bit. You know, there was a call for a dialogue. Yeah. And then there was a massive march of the population that was, like, incredible. I mean, the photos are, like, it's the biggest march in Nicaraguan history since the revolution.
Yeah, it's, like, 1 million people, I think, and then the country has 6 million, is a population of 6 million, so it was, like, 1/6 of them.
They were marching specifically
to demand justice
okay.
for the people who had been killed, for people who had been disappeared, who may have still been in jail or had been injured, and also there's a large contingent of people who are saying this action by the government is so unacceptable that Ortega needs to resign. That he needs to go.
Because this was... He spoke on Sunday after the 2 days of like, the police were really going on a killing spree. Like, the murder... Like, the toll was, like, had doubled in over the weekend, I think. Mm-hmm. And so it was, like, the... On Friday, his wife, the vice president, spoke. But it was... From my understanding, it was just, like, very just light talk of, like, oh, we need to all... you know, band together and, you know, like, vandalism is bad and stuff.
And she was insulting the protesters.
Yeah,
she was insulting. As, like, these, you know, troublemakers who are funded by the, you know, outside governments like the CIA or something.
Yeah. Like, I know a lot of people were very angry because this was, this is after they had, like, shut down the news sites. They've, like, done all these authoritarian things. And, like, just to, like, silence, like, what was actually happening in the streets of the police. I think from what I gathered, like, there was no word from the president and his wife until that Friday. And so, like, those 3 days of, like, just increased violence, like, I think it was mm-hmm. just Nicaragua turned into a police state. Like, the police were the ones in charge of what was going on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, I think, you know, I think Ortega had a role in, like, how violent it got because they had to have had orders to do the shooting and killing. But I do know, like, it was, like, when they announced this talk, people were making memes about them because it was, like, oh, this talk is going to lead to nowhere. This church burned down on Friday, I think, or on on Thursday. And so there's videos of, like, the protesters who are in there who had written their names on their arms. And, like, they had sent it to their friends who had sent it to their friends who had just sent it to their friends. So everyone was new, or, like, kind of, like, live watching, kind of, like, through, like, a Snapchat-type video of, like, them, like, protesting and, the like, them being stuck in the cathedral and, like, the police coming and, like, burning it down and like, going in and killing them mm-hmm. and stuff. And so it was just, like, after watching that and then watching, like, the church burn down and all these people who had been live Snapchatting die, people were just, like, we're not, like, you mm-hmm. are, like, we're not listening to you. Like, this is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I definitely think the incident with the church was also kind of a pivotal moment because they were bringing people who had been wounded or people who needed protection into the cathedral in Managua, and people were bringing donations to the cathedral to help these victims of the violence. And there was video that was circulating on social media of the police actually trying to take those supplies that people were trying to donate away from the people who had been hurt. And so this kind of imagery, I mean, there were also several religious leaders. There's a bishop in Nicaragua who came out strongly against the government in favor of the students and their protests and, you know, demanded that the violence stop. And, like, I think that played a major role. And the business community, so the major business council, kind of like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, but in Nicaragua, they came out and they said, like, we are in support of these protests and we want the violence to end. And that was a really big step because those big companies have kind of been aligned with Ortega because Ortega has been protecting them, you know, private property and investment and all this kind of thing. Like, that's been sort of a compromise that Ortega has made over the last decade that he's been in power. So, like, the business community coming out in support of the students, that was a big turning point as well.
Yeah, because I do know that my cousin was, like, hopeful because she's, like, that Friday during the day, there was like corporations were having, like, peaceful walkouts mm-hmm. in like, in support of the reform and just, like, in remembrance of, like, the police brutality that was, like, currently going on. And so, like, I know everyone was very, like, surprised and happy to see that, like, these corporations, like, were having, like, whole, like, the entire building would have, like, walkouts and stuff. When I first read about it in, like, on Thursday or Friday, it was saying, the news was mostly reporting stuff that, like, protesters were causing damage and that, like, people who have died were the pro-government people, which I was like, that's not correct. They're not talking about the 12, like, people who have died, like, and then with, like, you know, like, with this, like, hashtag, you know, like, I started seeing, like, famous people being like, oh, you know, my, you know, hairdresser wants me to talk about this issue, so, like, SOS Nicaragua, and then it's when everyone's like, oh my god, this is what's happening, and I think, because my relatives, like, they were just telling me, like, just share this information, and that's what I think everyone has been telling, like, Nicaraguans have been telling their people, like, outside of the country.
Right, so just to pick up on this thread about, like, the state's control of the media for a minute, there's most of the TV channels in Nicaragua are owned by the government or by friends or family related to Ortega at this point. There's only two or three that are considered independent. And then there's one newspaper that is sympathetic to the government and one independent newspaper and then one online newspaper. So La Prensa and Confidencial are independent and kind of critical of the government. And those are the only outlets, other than 100% Noticias, where some of this, like, critical factual information has been shared, because on the government channels, that information was not being reported. So people were using Facebook, they were using Twitter, they were using Instagram, they were using WhatsApp. You know, they're using every other means possible to communicate with one another. And I think that turned out to be really powerful. I mean, it does present some issues, right, in terms of, like, being able to verify information. So, like, one of the things that's unverifiable at this point is exactly how many people have died. There's no consensus, even among the human rights organizations, because they all have access to different cases. And so, and, you know, who's responsible for each person's death? I mean, the autopsies haven't even been completed for the majority of these murders. So there's a lot of unanswered questions still. And so it's important to let those investigations unfold, and hopefully there actually will be full investigations The Fiscalía, the public prosecutor's office, has promised that there will be an investigation, but it's a subject of skepticism among many Nicaraguans on whether or not that will actually happen, because again, the prosecutor's office is also very tied and politicized in terms of the government. So
yeah,
right. And then to your point about the dialogue talks, I was reading today that a lot of folks are saying, no, we can't have these dialogue. Sure, great, dialogue talks, awesome, but we can't do that until these investigations go through, or until we have, you know, reconciliation around what happened. And so what does it look like to want to have reconciliation, but that process being elongated mm-hmm. because of the investigations?
Right. I would say many people think that dialogue is useless unless there's accountability. So there's, you know, on the one hand, there's a discourse like, oh, we need to have peace in Nicaragua. And then there's another set of people saying, no, like, there can be no peace without justice, you know? And so it's just going through the motions. If we have a dialogue, entre comillas, right, in quotes, but really we're not acknowledging this wrongdoing that has taken place, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the Parliament of Nicaragua just voted to establish what they're calling a Comisión de la Verdad y la Paz y la Justicia, so a commission for justice and peace and reconciliation. But people are sort of mocking that, saying, like, how is the National Assembly, which is majority Sandinista, in a position to themselves or even to nominate others who will be objective, you know, observers and interpreters of what has gone on in the last week or so?
Yeah. And what does it look like to move forward with that trauma? I know you do a lot of work with trauma and sociopolitical situations. So what does it look like for the population to move forward with the trauma of what's happened?
I mean, I would say the first step is to acknowledge it. And that's something that we've seen going on in Nicaragua for the past couple of days. There's been just a series of marches and vigils, people, you know, printing out large photos of all the people who have died and bringing candles and prayers. In fact, the Catholic Church organized a massive vigilia just the other day to, you know, invite people to come together and to share their stories with one another. And I think that's the first step toward any kind of process of healing, to acknowledge, like, you're not alone, like, we're in this together, you know, to express solidarity, to grieve together collectively, because it is a collective loss for the country, you know. And there's, you know, been this movement for everyone is carrying blue and white flags, the flag of Nicaragua, and that's something that in my research, like, I would never see in protest. You know, everybody would be carrying these very specific banners about their issue. And so there's this sense of, like, we need to unite around our identity as Nicaraguans, as people in this country. And I think that's really powerful.
Yeah, they're, like, in a bunch of videos that I have and, like, that I've kind of, like, really kept important to me are, like, the ones where there's, like, a group of protesters, like, before I got really violent, where, or, like, in the middle of it, where they're all chanting, saying, like, we are not afraid, and everyone has the flags. Yeah, like, the Nicaraguan flag has been, like, a big symbol of this. And then also just, I'm like, man, I've never seen so much, like, country pride before, you know, like, especially here in the U.S., that's, like, no longer, like, a big thing, but, like, watching, like, everyone unite together over, like, the flag was very, like, moving, especially, like, to me. I was just, like, me and my brother have been posting lots of, like, go, like, the motherland type things. I also, like, did kind of want to ask, because a big thing I saw was when the pictures were going around where, like, a lot of people were kind of, you know, triggered in a sense, because it looked exactly like the revolution, mm-hmm. where, like, the people who were, like, the protesters and the police is, like, they had the same barricades. It's, like, I know a lot of people have been, like, really moved and being like, mm-hmm. wow, like, this is just like the civil war that we had that was, like, mm-hmm. very scarring and is still very scarring to, like, mm-hmm. the Nicaraguan people.
Right. And I would say that's actually one of the things that may explain why people reacted so strongly so fast, is that that imagery is very evocative of the revolutionary period, and people are still living with the consequences of that and the trauma of that war, you know, families being split in two and people losing siblings and other family members. And just thinking about how those images, you know, symbolize something that they never want to go back to again. And so yeah. It was so important to immediately take a stand and say, we are not going to live through months or years of this again. Like, it cost us too much as a country to ever go back down that road. And so we need to immediately just stand up and say no.
Like, what are your thoughts on, like, how the country will move forward knowing that image has, like, kind of just been seared into people's minds out of nowhere?
I would say that instead of thinking of this as, like, something that's already over and they're going to move forward from, we should think of it more as, like, a spark that mm-hmm. has started something new. So we should think of it as an opportunity for the country to potentially go in a new direction than the one that it's been going in for the last 10 years. And it could lead to a reckoning of the current government. I'm not saying that I think Ortega is going to resign or even that I think there might be a new election, but I am saying I think it has mobilized the population in a way that if they stay engaged and in the streets and demanding justice, that that is a way to get to a different result than the one that people lived through 30 years ago, you know?
Yeah.
That if people continue to peacefully protest in the streets and the government chooses to exercise restraint and not violently repress these protests and perhaps really does authentically negotiate, then perhaps there could be a different result. On the other hand, it's sort of like two paths diverge in a wood. If at some point it's clear that the government does not want to negotiate or compromise or change any of its current practices to acknowledge the very real concerns of the majority of the population, then I think it's very possible that what we saw last week could happen again and very soon. So I think it's too early to tell which path we're going to go down.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I think for right now, the most important thing that people are kind of watching is what's going to happen with this mesa de diálogo, like this dialogue that's supposed to involve all the different sectors. I mean, there's still students holed up in La Upoli, the Polytechnic University in Managua, who are afraid to show their faces or come out and speak to the media for fear of repression, you know, and they are basically like camped out, you know, demanding that these negotiations actually happen, a dialogue actually happen. And they're trying to mobilize all the rest of the university students to come together as kind of a united front as university students to make these demands more powerful.
Right.
Because historically, university students have been, you know, kind of the vanguard of change in Nicaragua. And so that could be the case this time as well.
Yeah, because I wanted to add my family is very hopeful of that because most of the universities have been vandalized, burned down, very vandalized. Like, you know, people have not been able to go to classes, not only because they're worried that the government is going to kill them, but also just because there's like no classrooms to go to in some sections of the university. So I feel like that was a kind of a big thing for like all Nicaraguans where it's like, okay, well, you know, as university students, we're going to keep going because we don't even have, you know, like, because of this issue, we don't even have, like, a university to go to, you mm-hmm. know? And so
I don't think classes are in session currently at any of the universities still.
After, like, last week, I think people were still going to work during all of this violence. They had to take, like, side streets and stuff. Yeah.
Right. I feel like that's a big part of it is how do you resume normal day-to-day
exactly mm-hmm.
in that situation
mm-hmm. and people are certainly trying. I mean, there's a lot of informal economic activity in Nicaragua, so people who sell food on the street and this kind of thing, like, they aren't stopping, you know. Maybe they're avoiding certain areas of the city depending on how safe they feel like it might be, but people still need to make a living, you know. I mean, that's why you see, like, there was a young man who was killed who was selling water on the street, and he just happened to be in the crossfire that day, you know, and that's why he died. And so, I mean, there's examples like that of people who just were in the wrong place at the wrong time, and that's because people in Nicaragua are very hardworking, and they're always, you know, trying to feed their families, and the problem is that not only are the police potentially involved in these things, but again, there's these sort of, like, non-state but state-affiliated groups like the Juventud Sandinista, but also just like local neighborhood gangs that could take advantage of the situation, and people are uncertain about how secure any particular place is. And, you know, it's sort of ironic because Nicaragua has built its reputation over the last 10 years on this idea that they are a safe country, at least in comparison yeah. to other countries in Central America, which are constantly in the U.S. news because of migration issues, you know, and the poverty and violence and things like that, and gangs and that motivate that migration here. Whereas Nicaraguans there aren't as many in the United States, and that has a lot to do with a lot of historical context that we don't have time to get into. But the point being that people have a different impression of Nicaragua than they do of the rest of Central America. But that reputation, I think, is taking a hit this week because of everything that's gone on. And so it's sort of ironic in that way and sad for the Nicaraguan people who are to blame. Like, they are innocent victims of this this change in the way that the country may be perceived internationally as suddenly unstable or violent. And that's only going to have negative repercussions for the most vulnerable people in the country, you know, who may not be able to make a living if there isn't as much tourism, for example. So, I mean, these are some of the other long-term consequences, in addition to the political consequences that we already talked about with the government itself. But, like, ordinary people are going to continue to suffer regardless because of the way this has sort of exploded in the news and how people will interpret that.
Do you all have any final thoughts or closing points that you want to make about how to stay updated or about what, you know, what's ahead for Nicaragua?
I definitely want to say that people should still check that hashtag because it's been, like, the biggest way that people have been, like, updating, like, what's been going on and stuff because...
And the hashtag is SOS Nicaragua?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, like, one thing that really bothered me was that there, like, no news sites were reporting. I had to, like, work hard to look for, like, news of what was going on, like, at the height of the... Or, like, on Friday, which was, like, at that point was, like, a very critical point in the whole thing.
So I would say that if your listeners speak Spanish, they should check out La Prensa and Confidencial, who have highly reputable reporting going on.
I think they also have a little English button at the top.
They do. So you should be able to read some of their coverage in English. And there's a few U.S.-based sources that have been doing some pretty good reporting. The New York Times, there's a reporter named Frances Robles, who's currently in Nicaragua. She's done an excellent report just the other day about the students themselves and their movement and what they're trying to accomplish. And then in terms of the donations, my advice would be to look for reputable organizations in Nicaragua that have a long history working there and donate through those organizations rather than anything that just kind of emerges right now, because it's very difficult to verify where that money will go if you don't know exactly whose hands it's going into. And that's just good advice for any donation, but especially in this instance where things on social media, although it is a good way to get information, we can't always trust everything at face value.
Yeah.
So it's better to work through reputable established organizations.